You're listening to the Leaping Cholla podcast, recorded in the Wrong Mountain Yurt in the Sonoran Desert.
I am falling away from this world. I am falling away from this world.
We're going. We are on section 100.
Applause, please.
Applause,
please.
Yeah. I thought you said a pause, please. Like, yeah, I gave you that. Section 100 of Contributions to Philosophy of the Event, page 153. Not even halfway through the book. But yeah, we should get going, huh?
Yeah. Okay. 100, the first beginning. In the first beginning, beings are experienced as physis and are so named. Beingness as constant presence is still veiled therein. Physis as prevailing emergence. The fact that beingness was grasped as constant presence from ancient times counts already for most people as a ground already, if they ever do ask about grounds. But the early and inceptual character of this interpretation of beings does not immediately constitute a ground. Quite to the contrary, it makes the interpretation all the more problematic. An appropriate inquiry will show that the truth of beingness is not asked about at all. For the thinking distinctive of the first beginning, the interpretation is ungrounded and cannot be grounded, and rightly so, if to explain by leading back to another being is understood as constituting a ground.
A grounding, yeah.
A grounding. Nevertheless, this interpretation of uv and physis, and later as idea, is not entirely groundless, though its ground, i.e. its truth, is indeed hidden. It could be argued that the experience of impermanence, of coming to be and passing away, had suggested and called up, as a countermeasure, the positing of constancy and presence. Yet how is it that things which come to be and pass away count as non-beings? Indeed, that happens only if beingness is already determined as constancy and presence. Therefore, beingness is not read off from beings or from non-beings. Rather, beings are projected upon this beingness in order to first show themselves in the open realm of this projection as beings or non-beings.
Yeah, I guess I should talk.
Yeah.
In the first beginning, the establishment of metaphysics by the Greeks, beings are experienced as physis and are so named. And physis means nature. So beings are experienced as, I guess in a sense, the things of nature, as having nature, as the things before us, the physical things. Beingness as constant presence is still veiled therein. Physis as prevailing emergence. I think beingness veiled therein means that in the experience of physis, or beings as physis, the idea of beingness or essence remains hidden and kind of tacit, I would say, assumed. The fact that beingness was grasped as constant presence from ancient time counts already for most people as a ground already, if they ever do ask about grounds. So I think he's saying that, you know, beingness was grasped as constant presence is enough for people to say, well, that is a ground for believing it's true. But the early and inceptual character of this interpretation of beings does not immediately constitute a ground. Quite to the contrary, it makes the interpretation of all the more problematic. An appropriate inquiry will show that the truth of beingness is not asked about at all. For the thinking distinctive of the first beginning, the interpretation is ungrounded. It cannot be grounded, and rightly so, if to explain by leading back to another being is understood as constituting a grounding. So yeah, in other words, this idea of beingness as constant presence is not grounded in truth. That interpretation is problematic. And he gives an interesting little reason here. It says that interpretation is ungrounded and can't be grounded because by grounded we mean explaining something according to something else, explaining a being according to another being. So you ground a being on a being. But
he's saying that's grounding in the first beginning, or that's...
No, that's what grounding is, I think he's saying.
But that's...
What's that?
That's not really what grounding is it?
I mean, grounding is a gigantic field of philosophy now.
So he's saying this is the right way to think about grounding.
I think so.
Okay.
I mean, I think what he's pointing out is that when you ground something, you say, well, this is grounded on that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a being is grounded on a being. Mm-hmm. You need to ground things on other things.
Mm-hmm.
He's saying that it's not possible to ground this conception because there's no being on which to ground it, because its interpretation of being or beingness in a sense, in a sense, it's a loop. Circular.
Mm-hmm.
Just grounding being on being or beingness on beingness.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, there is like a circularity to grounding in general if it's a being on a being, but I think he's going to probably go on talk about different aspects of being and different types of being grounded on different types of being.
Mm-hmm.
Let me look at the next paragraph. Nevertheless, this interpretation of I think being as physis, mm-hmm. and later as idea, is not entirely groundless, though its ground is indeed hidden. So he says it has a ground, but it's hidden, so we need to reveal it. It could be argued that the experience of impermanence, of coming to be and passing away, had suggested and called up as a countermeasure the positing of constancy and presence. In other words, the experience of things coming to being and then passing away from being as a kind of immediate phenomenon of perceptual experience, as the phrase he has here is suggested and called up as a countermeasure, the positing of constancy and presence. In other words, sort of an instinctual drive to offer a counterproposal to this impermanence by saying, well, impermanence must be non-being or beings passing into non-being. So things that are constant and present are, in a sense, beingness or essence or the eternal feature of things. And how is it that things which come to be and pass away count as non-beings? So when something passes away, why does it become a non-being? Indeed, that happens only if beingness is already determined as constancy and presence. That's right. I mean, if beingness is constancy mm-hmm. and presence, then non-beingness is inconstancy and non-presence.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, beingness is not read off from beings or from non-beings. I think what he means is we don't come to the idea of beingness from beings or from non-beings. Rather, beings are projected upon this beingness in order to first show themselves in the open realm of this projection as beings or non-beings. So this beingness, in a sense, comes first. And we project beings onto this beingness. Mm-hmm. I think that the interesting things in these paragraphs are that when he says, he sets up this little developmental triangle, this interpretation of being as physis and later as idea, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So this OV word, this Greek word OV, it'd be nice if we could, I mean, I think that's, I think that's it's right that that's being.
Yeah, it says here that which is beings.
That which is beings.
That which is semicolon beings.
Yeah, yeah. Where does it say that?
In the Greek English glossary at the back of the book.
Well, we should refer to that more often.
Yeah. Well, that's, we do, but not all the words are in here.
Oh, really? Yeah. Okay, great. Well, sometimes my little Kindle interpreter works, and sometimes that works, so maybe together we'll actually be able to read the book.
Great.
So, okay, beings, physis, and idea is an interesting little sort of triangle, or maybe a little evolution. But I think what's interesting to me is like at the very beginning, beings are experienced as physis and are so named. Beingness as constant presence is still veiled therein. So the important thing he's trying to talk about here is, in a sense, particulars and universals, existence and essence, being and beingness. You know, the Greeks wrestled with this idea of like, you know, if there's all these individual horses, well, there must be the idea of the horse. That's how we can tell. Like, how do you tell that that's a horse, that's a horse, that's a horse? Mm-hmm. In the end, the answer is hoarseness. Mm-hmm. That it is, to varying degrees, they gave a real ontological status to the ideas or the forms. Like hoarseness was real. It was a form. It had existence. We related to it just as we might a cup of water, because those forms made everything possible. I mean, we wouldn't know that this horse, that this object, and this object are horses without hoarseness. So this beingness, and that's that idea, form, beingness, essence, these eternal things that are constant and present, are really kind of the big, in a sense, the big invention of the first beginning, mm-hmm. the establishment of this idea of ideas and forms and eternal constant presences. So he's trying to map this thing, but he's, you know, he's calling up some interesting aspects of it, meaning, you know, it's an ungrounded idea, he's saying, for instance. I think he's saying that it's an idea that, the beingness is something that beings and non-beings are projected onto. So the idea that beings came first and then beingness next is a little reversed in Heidegger's view. And he's just kind of breaking down how our minds and our experiences, as he says, the experiences of impermanence, the interpretations of constancy and presence, have come to rely on and have this idea of beings, non-beings, beingness, constancy, presence, impermanence, how these categories and these definitional clusters, nodes, have come to be, how they relate to truth, and how, and ultimately how they determine how we think about the world. Mm-hmm. For instance, I think one like sort of real world implication of this question is when you're relating to a horse, let's use a horse as an example, how much are you relating to that horse and how much are you relating to horseness? Mm. So how much are you relating to an individual fear and how much are you relating to all the fear you have or what fear is in essence, what your interpretation of fear is. Mm-hmm. When you're dealing with your mother, how much are you dealing with an individual person and how much are you dealing with kind of essential qualities of motherness or of your mother that are overweighing and overshadowing the individual person. Maybe even a little bit like with my talk about my oldest daughter in the last episode, you know, how much when she sends me extremely vituperative texts describing how bad I am, I was very aware of I wanted to like wreak some vengeance on her. Like she made me mad and I wanted to like attack her. And I noticed over the course of the week, the sort of the more aggravated I got at like, I don't know, for lack of a better phrase, like the liberal bullshit in my feed, the more I wanted to like get on my phone and like respond to her. You know what I mean? So I was relating to her as like, there's many ways, many levels and many forms that she can take for me. In one sense, she could just be my daughter who has some grievances against me, and she has a lot of grievances against a lot of things, and I let her be and offer her my love and just be kind and listen, you know. But then she starts to symbolize. It's really that idea that people symbolize things. At that point where things start to symbolize other things, and you start reacting to those things as you are, you start to shunt the reactions to the things they symbolize onto them, right? Yeah, That's the degree to which you are confounding beingness and being, essence and existence, universal and particular. So these very philosophical ideas have some real solid ramifications for how we think about how we interact with the world.
Yeah.
Our anxieties, our angers, our assumptions.
Objectification.
Objectification is a good one, exactly. Identity.
Yeah.
Oh, look, it's a black person, or it's a white person, or it's a man, or it's a woman. Well, what does that mean? I mean, we adhere all these generalities onto people. We assume millions of things about them because they belong to an essence. But those things might have nothing to do with them.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's the peril of identity and identitarianism, is that you you habitually, addictively ingrain essential qualities into individuals because of the group that they're in.
And in a way, all words do that.
Yes.
Like anytime you use a word.
Yes.
You're calling on your essence of the
signifier signified is basically that. I mean, and signifier signified is the backbone of the last 70 years of intercontinental philosophy and post-structuralism and all that crap. Signifier is the particular, and signified is the general. So yeah, when you use a word, I mean, how particular are you being with that word? How much of that word's weight and that word's history are you compounding with that thing you're assigning to the word? It's honestly something you will never break free of. Nobody will ever break free of it. Essence and existence interrelate and intercollude with each other, and the mind is a battleground between those two darknesses, you know, and like in a sense, existentials have no meaning without essences, and essences destroy the meaning of existentials. So it's really a total conundrum. Mm-hmm. You can't have existentials without essences, but you can't have, you can't have existentials without essences, but if you have essences, you can't have existentials.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That really sums up the paradox of cognition in our day and age. And by
in the first beginning.
Maybe the paradise that Heidegger is holding out to us is this idea that maybe someday we will solve that conundrum and we will be able to have existentials without essences. And we will be able to have essences that don't destroy existentials. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But it's an interesting...
Yeah, totally.
So let's keep going.
Whence and why is the opening of beingness always a projection? Whence and why is this projection a projection of beings upon time itself not understood? Are both of these interdependent? Ecstatic time and projection grounded as Dasein.
Yeah, so when we say beingness as a projection, I think what he's kind of pointing out there is a little bit what we just said, which mm-hmm. is that essence projects onto existence. Universals project onto particulars. Mm-hmm. Hoarseness projects onto what we're looking at, the horse we're looking at. Whence and why is this projection a projection of beings upon time? So, you know, when hoarseness projects a horse, that horse is projected into time. It's the horse's, that individual horse's presence in time that renders it a being and not beingness. And are these interdependent? It seems that they are. Ecstatic time and projection grounded as Dasein. Ecstatic time is the whole panoply and panorama of time, and projection is, as he says, beingness projecting onto time, projecting beings onto time, and this time and this being projection are grounded as Dasein. We are, in a sense, the grounding of this timely projection. Mm-hmm. Heidegger would say that Dasein, or in a sense, what human beingness makes this this sort of little union of time and projection and beingness projection on time is something only humans can really relate to, can only discuss, obviously, and only have actually an experience of. Yeah, go ahead.
That the truth of being remains concealed, although beingness is placed in it, time must be grounded in the essence of the first beginning. Does not this concealment of the ground of the truth of being also mean that the history of Greek Dasein, a Dasein determined by this truth, was placed on the shortest path, and that the present was completed in a great and unique creative moment? Does it not also mean, on the other hand, that what follows the first beginning is delayed and has to withstand a self-refusal of being all the way up to the abandonment by being? The transition to the other beginning needs to prepare a knowledge of this historical destiny. The confrontation with the first beginning and with its history also belongs here. Platonism dominates this history and determines a certain manner of dealing with the guiding question, a manner that can be indicated by the title, Being and Thinking.
Yeah. That the truth of being remains concealed, although beingness is placed in it, time must be grounded in the essence of the first beginning. So time, in a sense, when he's saying is when being projects beings into time, the truth of bang, which is, in a sense, is time, remains concealed. We accept this projection and we view beings as projections of beingness, and we don't ask about the truth of bang, which is, in a sense, is like the medium or the time in which they're placed. We don't So we think about the horse as a projection of horseness, but we don't really have a solid understanding of horse in time, or at least we have not philosophically conceptualized horse in time. Mm-hmm. And does not this concealment of the ground of the truth of being also mean that the history of Greek Dasein, a Dasein determined by this truth, was placed on the shortest path, and that the present was completed in a great and unique creative moment? I mean, I think basically he's saying here, this concealment of the truth of bang, due to this template that the Greeks handed us of beingness projecting beings onto time, this concealment of the ground of the truth of being, and the ground of the truth of being would be the truth of bang, or the truth of time, means that the history of Greek Dasein, so the history of how the Greeks were there in existence, mm-hmm. how the Greek human beingness, its history, which was a history or a Dasein determined by this truth, the ground of the truth of being, it was placed on the shortest path. Not sure what that means. I think it just kind of, well, maybe it just means it happened during the sort of Greek flowering of discovery, and that the present we live in was completed in a great and unique creative moment. So the great and unique creative moment is the life of Plato and Aristotle and the Greeks. But our present, where we currently live, was almost completed by that little path, by that little time, by that moment in philosophical history. Mm-hmm. Does it not also mean, on the other hand, that what follows the first beginning, meaning everything after it, is delayed? Mm-hmm. In a sense, delayed meaning held back by its own past, and has to withstand a self-refusal of being all the way up to the abandonment by being. So in a sense, we're living in this age of being self-refused, we're living in the age of being concealed, being ungrounded, being hidden, the truth of bang being hidden. We are living in a sense in the aftermath of the abandonment by being. We are living the abandonment by being. Mm-hmm. The transition to the other beginning needs to prepare a knowledge of this historical destiny. Yes, we've heard that. Mm-hmm. The confrontation with the first beginning and with its history also belongs here. Yes, Platonism dominates this history and determines a certain manner of dealing with the guiding question, which is what is being, a manner that can be indicated by the title being and thinking. Which is what we've just been talking about, is how mm-hmm. being and thought interrelate, and how this interpretation of being that the Greeks handed us determines how we think, and how our thinking navigates the various forms of being and dynamics of being that we have been handed, and how we understand them. Yeah. Okay, yeah, so did you want to say anything?
No.
So we have this little 1-2, yeah. Which is really on the words being and thinking. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
But to understand this title correctly, it must be noted. 1, the word being in this title refers to beingness, and not, as in being and time, to being itself originarily interrogated in its truth. Beingness as what holds in general for beings.
Yeah, that's the essence, that's the universal, that's the beingness. Yeah.
Thinking is meant in the sense of the representing of something in general. And this representing is understood as presentifying, and thus anticipating the sphere in which beings are grasped with respect to constant presence, though without the temporal character of this interpretation ever coming to be recognized. Indeed, it is recognized so little that even after the unprecedented interpretation of
being,
Usha, being as constant presence in being and time, and the grasping of presence in its temporal character, people still speak of the timelessness of presence and eternity. They do so because they adhere to the common concept of time, a concept that is taken merely as the frame for the changeable and thereby is unable to find fault with what is constantly present.
Exclamation point.
Exclamation point.
Yeah, so he says in this title, Being and Thinking.
Well, he's basically like, I mean, not being, but beingness.
Yes.
And by when I say being, okay.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah, which in the German that might be clearer, but
yeah, and yeah, it looks like he's referring maybe to a lecture course.
Yeah,
that he's titled. Yeah, specifically.
Yeah, and then I think beautifully here, thinking is meant in the sense of the representing of something in general, and this representing is understood as presentifying and thus anticipating the sphere in which things, in which beings are grasped with respect to constant presence, though without the temporal character of the serpentine. So it's really good to note here and remember that by thinking, he means representation. Mm-hmm. And by representation, he means representing things to ourselves, mm-hmm. presentifying the world. Now, so what he in a very basic sense, what he means is words provide mm-hmm. us with a constant presence that we take for being, even though they're actually just words, mm-hmm. Meaning they certainly have semantic resonance. They certainly have things they indicate. They certainly have meanings. They certainly relate to the world in a variety of ways. But we take with every word we use, we take it as presentifying the thing that word represents. Mm-hmm. And so we relate to beings through represented being, which in a sense is being abandoned by being. Mm-hmm. So this question of representation and how, for lack of a better phrase, real it is, or how much being there is in our representational tools, mm-hmm. is one of the things that Heidegger, really kind of opened up as a can of worms that was again picked up by the post-structuralists and Derrida and Foucault, mm-hmm. and all these people, mm-hmm. As being a question. So because really what they studied was the question of representation and how much being there is in representation, how representation forms and affects the mind and is affected by, informed by it, and what its social and psychological and linguistic and ramifications are. Post-structuralism is just is in a sense just the philosophy of representation. Indeed, it is recognized so little that even after the unprecedented interpretation of Usha as constant presence in being and time, and the grasping of presence in its temporal character, even after I wrote a book talking about how beingness is not,
being is constant presence.
Yeah. Well, even after.
But wait, is that being or beingness? I can look it up.
Yeah, I think it's. Well, my phone interprets it as
beingness.
Substance, but I think it's beingness.
Beingness.
It's the thing that all beings have. Substance was kind of one of the ways the Greek thought of it. It's everything has substance. That's the beingness of beings. Mm-hmm. It's the thing that is common to beings. So Heidegger's saying I provided an unprecedented interpretation. of showing how the Greeks thought of substance as constant presence. Even though it doesn't need to be, and people, and the grasping of presence in its temporal character. So I talked about how we need to think about presence in its temporal character. People still speak of the timelessness of presence and eternity, which I think Heidegger considers a mistake. They do so because they adhere to the common concept of time, a concept that's taken merely as the frame. So time is just a frame for the changeable. And thereby is unable to find fault with what is constantly find fault with what is constantly present. Yeah, find fault. They do so because they adhere to the common concept of time, a concept that is taken merely as the frame for the changeable, and thereby is unable to find fault with what is constantly present. Yeah, I'm not sure what find fault means. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think what he's saying is, this common concept of time, and we talked about this like an episode ago or two, that has a kind of neutered and scaffoldish mm-hmm. concept of time, that it's just kind of like a thing that things change in. It's like a dressing room for things, and our interpretation of beings and existence doesn't really ever link the changeable and time together in a dynamic, interdependent way. So time is just kind of hidden, and it's like a neutral frame in which everything is placed. And I think that people who have that concept and adhere to that concept of time are unable to sort of look analytically or critically at the idea of constant presence. That constant presence is something they accept because they are part of that view that time, it just kind of doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that's kind of what he's saying. Mm-hmm. Maybe we should read a little more, so then we can finish this section. Yeah.
Do you know what these three Greek words are?
Yeah. So, I mean,
the second is seeing, idea of.
There's three.
Oh, yeah.
Logos is the middle one.
Yeah, right.
Do you know the first one?
No, but I can look it up.
Thinking as, yeah, look it up. My Kindle definition is not.
Has failed. It was doing so well at one point.
Yeah. See if I can copy it.
That means, hold on, I almost have it. Think, apprehend. Think, semicolon, apprehend.
Great. So I think
so
it's thinking.
Basically thinking. Greek for thinking. Okay.
Thinking. Oh, there it is.
Thinking as
thinking. Logos, which I think would be.
Words.
I mean, reason, probably.
Right.
And idea, or.
Idea of seeing.
Seeing. Yeah, that interpretation there goes back to what we talked about, I think, about again last time, mm-hmm. was that the way the Greeks saw eidos and idea and form mm-hmm. was the look of a thing, mm-hmm. the look, the way it looks, the way it's seen. So again, take the horse example. What's the idea of a horse? Well, it's the look of a horse. So the three horses sitting there, how do you know they're all three horses? Because they all have the horse look, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. It's another way of saying they have the horse form. Mm-hmm. They all participated in the idea of horseness. Mm-hmm. They look like horses, mm-hmm. right? So, yeah.
Yeah. Thinking as...
Thought, think. Reason, and seeing.
Thought, reason, and seeing. Here means reasoning, the comportment by which and in whose sphere beingness is determined, even if in a quite underground manner.
Ungrounded. An underground manner. I think underground would be interesting. I wish you'd written that. But yeah, ungrounded manner.
Ungrounded manner. To be distinguished from this is, quote, thinking in the broader and still to be determined sense of philosophizing, cf. Inceptual thinking. In this regard, every apprehension and determination, concept of beingness and of being is a matter of thinking. Yet the decisive question remains, in what domain of truth does the uncovering of the essence of being take place? Basically, even where, as in the history of the guiding question, beingness is grasped on the basis of
thinking
in Greek. Mm-hmm. The truth of this thinking is not what is thought as such, but is time space as the essential occurrence of truth, wherein all representing must abide. At the beginning, a being was always determined also as a ev, in Greek. Do we know what that means?
No idea.
Ev is one.
Hmm.
So that for Aristotle, Ev and Ov,
a being and a one,
are convertible.
Yes.
Unity constitutes beingness, and unity means here unification, original concentration into the self-sameness of what is constant and integrally present. The preeminent determination of the thinking of beingness, unity, is then appropriately the unity of the, quote, I think, the unity of transcendental apperception, the self-sameness of the I. Leibniz joins both of these in a deeper and richer sense in the monad.
Yeah, cool. So by thinking, I mean reasoning. Okay, he says, the comportment by which and in whose sphere beingness is determined. So reasoning, logos, thought, perception, this is the domain, the sphere in which beingness is determined. Beingness is determined by thought, even if in a quite ungrounded manner. To be distinguished from this is thinking in the broader and still to be determined sense of philosophizing. So thinking as, you know, the way we philosophize and think about things is to be distinguished from this sort of reasoning or this sphere in which beings are determined. I would say one kind of thinking is the sphere of representation, and the other is the sphere of, let's call it, cognition. In this regard, every apprehension and determination, aka concept of beingness and of bang, is a matter of thinking. Thinking gives us these determinations and apprehensions. There's no beingness or bang without thinking. There is nothing but thinking doth make it so, as Shakespeare says. Yet the decisive question remains, in what domain of truth does the uncovering of the essence of being take place? Now, domain of truth is a phrase I don't really know what. I couldn't list a single domain of truth, but apparently there are domains of truth. But we shall maybe see if he enlightens us on that. But in what domain of truth does the uncovering of the essence of being take place? Where does the essence of being be uncovered? Basically, even where, as in the history of the guiding question, beingness is grasped on the basis of thinking, the truth of this thinking is not what is thought as such, but is time-space as the essential currents of truth wherein all... I'm lost. Basically, even where, I'm not sure what that means, as in the history of the guiding question... I get it. So basically, what he says is, basically, even where beingness is grasped on the basis of thinking, as it is in the history of the guiding question, right?
Mm-hmm.
The truth of this thinking, so basically, the truth of this thinking is not what is thought as such, but is time-space as the essential currents of truth wherein all representing must abide. Okay, that's lovely. Mm-hmm. Right? Do you get that?
So yeah.
What he's saying is that the truth of this thinking that establishes a sphere wherein beingness is determined, or even the truth of philosophical thinking, but probably more apropos the reasoning that he talks about at the very beginning here, the truth of this reasoning is not what is thought as such. So its truth is not what it's not thinking about.
Content of his thought.
Yeah, exactly. It's not thinking about truth, or its truth is not to be found in its content, but its truth is the time space as the essential currents of truth wherein all representing must abide. So he's shifting the locus of truth. And in a sense, this is it, the domain of truth. Mm-hmm. When he says,
yeah,
in what domain of truth? Well, he's saying the domain of truth, wherein the uncovering of the essence of being takes place, is not in the thought itself, mm-hmm. but the domain of truth is to be sought in the time space that provides that, or makes possible, the essential occurrence of truth, wherein all representing must abide. So he's bringing us back to time, relinking time and truth, calling us again to look at time, or time space, mm-hmm. as he says, for truth, because that's where representing abides. We have to stop thinking that representing abides in this kind of timeless place, mm-hmm. that our thoughts, that our words, that our concepts, that our representations themselves, that the signified itself has mm-hmm. any kind of out of time quality, any kind of mm-hmm. timelessness, any mm-hmm. kind of, so every time you have a thought or a representation mm-hmm. or consider something, work to think about it more timefully, more mm-hmm. time-spacefully. Because the more you do that, the more you start to address and maybe break free from this conundrum, which we just identified, which is that you can't have existence without essence, but when you have essence, you can't have existence. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let's finish.
So,
sorry, go ahead.
Well, we did.
Did you read the? Oh, yeah, you did.
Read,
yeah,
the
sorry.
Last one.
Yeah, did you want to say something?
Yeah. So I feel like if he's saying that, like, the truth of the thinking, let's say, it's not in the words or the thought or the content itself, but it's more, is it in a way just the fact that you are thinking? Is that what he's saying, or is there something else? Like, the time space is the essential occurrence of truth, and then where in all representing must abide, does that mean all thinking abides? Like, so all thinking does happen within.
I think so. Yeah, I think that's a good way to think about it. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit of a deflation of this whole idea, but I think he might say something along the lines of, when someone is presenting a thought.
Yeah.
Asking yourself if that thought contains truth or not, mm-hmm. without considering the context mm-hmm. of that event of thought, mm-hmm. is to not know its truth. Its truth is its context. Its truth is its placement in time space. Mm-hmm. And its placement in time space is not an irrelevant factor when it mm-hmm. comes to its truth. That's actually its truth. Mm-hmm. Like, that's where its truth occurs. Mm-hmm. Because that's where all representing abides. Representation happens in time-space. Mm-hmm. And it's that assumption that it happens outside of time-space, that we're dealing with eternal categories, that we're dealing with eternal principles, that we're talking about truisms, mm-hmm. truisms that are eternally true. Liberals do this, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, especially with liberals and politics. Mm-hmm. When liberals talk politics, you can hear it's a windstorm. Mm-hmm. Or let's call it a shitstorm of truisms that mm-hmm. are taken as out of time, and they're not mm-hmm. discussable because there's no reason to discuss them, because mm-hmm. no time will ever come where they're not true. So they decontextualize everything and make everything about abstract truisms,
right.
which shields them from discussion. And because they're right. saying that the truth of my thoughts lie in my thoughts and lie mm-hmm. in the fact that I'm claiming they have eternal truth.
Yeah.
But Heidegger is saying,
well, you can't argue with essences because there's nothing to argue.
They never pass away. Yeah, exactly. They never become false. They never die.
Yeah.
Their being always exists.
Yeah. Well, and they're disconnected from being. So
yes.
they're just you can't disprove an abstract concept of something. I mean,
no.
I guess you can, maybe, but
right, well, you can, but only with another abstract concept.
Right.
I mean, this is almost, this word common sense mm-hmm. is being used a lot now to kind of, and it's been used actually for hundreds of years to distinguish liberals from non-liberals, that non-liberals have common sense and liberals have mm-hmm. Eternal ideas mm-hmm. Or impractical ideals, mm-hmm. Unpractical ideals. Mm-hmm. Common sense, I would say, is the is philosophy and pragmatically inserted into time space as the essential currents of truth. Mm-hmm. It is interested in representation as a pragmatic event that actually has specific relevance to a certain time space, mm-hmm. as a solution or mm-hmm. an application. Totally. Right?
Yeah, it makes me think of this. What was it? We heard some like speech, and Trump was like saying, like, you know, I walk carefully downstairs. You know, I take my time.
Right.
I don't fall downstairs. Right. Now, for me as a recovering liberal, I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe he said that. He's gonna like fall downstairs, you know, like, or like, it's just this like feels like this real superstitious thing. But it's actually just common sense what he said. It's like, Okay, so let's not fall downstairs. And I don't know. I just thought it was an odd response that I was like,
you jinxed yourself.
Yeah. I felt like it was
Yeah. I mean, jinxing yourself is a really interesting idea, because what jinxing yourself means is if you say something, it's going to come true.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't end. Like, you said it, and now it's eternally true because I'm a liberal, and every word becomes an absolute essence mm-hmm. that always abides. Mm-hmm. And so jinxing yourself just means you're actually just setting yourself up to fail, because mm-hmm. in saying I walk downstairs carefully, like, I'm going to walk down these stairs carefully, or I choose mm-hmm. to walk downstairs, immediately the opposite or the negative along with the positive both become realms, or both become, you know, eternalized as representations, and so you're going to fall downstairs. Hence, you know, that's actually a really interesting little picture into why liberalism is anxiety, mm-hmm. because that's the way it relates to words. Words become, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. because in the realm of representation, the positive and the negative are equally present.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if you're saying, I could be careful to walk downstairs, what a liberal immediately instinctually reacts to is, oh, okay, there's the positive statement of that, but there's the negative statement of that, because both are possible in the eternal world of representation, where there's no real way to determine possibility or impossibility, because there's no events, there's no real world, there's no conditions, there's no circumstances. Mm-hmm. Everything is possible. Everything is impossible.
Yeah.
So everything is terrifying.
Yeah. So yeah, when I think it's also...
So speaking is like, jinxing.
Yeah, right. And there's also a similar idea of like this sort of like... what was it? We were talking about, I think, last time or the time before, about like letting someone take a stand, I don't know, and say something like, this is bad. I think it was sort of in the context, I can't remember. Do you remember? It was just like being able to say like, this is wrong and this is right.
Mm-hmm.
Even just something like that is, I think, really in liberalism, really hard, because you're like, well, but maybe there's some world in which this person actually, well, I mean, you hear it all over the place with this discussion of like illegal,
mm-hmm.
immigrants who have committed crimes, and then there are all these justifications for them, mm-hmm. and reasons why mm-hmm. it should be okay. And so mm-hmm. it's really hard to say this is wrong and this is right and this is the consequences, because then when you say this is the consequences to someone like me, then suddenly you're saying, oh wow, well, that could happen to me, or mm-hmm. that could, like,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I might, what if I was in that situation, became in that situation, and then that's the consequence? Like, I don't want mm-hmm. that consequence.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're quoting that country song we heard the other night in the bar, remember? We got our guns, we got our God, and we know wrong from right.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
I think we talked about it like a couple episodes ago too. Just this like idea of being able to say what's wrong and what's right is really hard.
Yeah,
for recovering liberals like myself.
Yeah, I mean, liberals don't have a huge problem saying some things are absolutely wrong.
Yeah, I guess
wrong.
You're right. Yes, that's true.
I mean, I think a dissection of what liberals are able to say is adamantly wrong and adamantly right, and then when they slip into moral relativism, that would be a very interesting thesis, dissertation, right? Like, because I think liberals are very morally relativized, but they're also very morally absolutist.
It's true, yeah.
So, but yeah, I think they use those things selectively, strategically.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
At the beginning, a being was always determined also as a one. This is interesting. I've been reading about this in the Greek world, unity. Unity and beingness are the same thing. And unity means a unification, original concentration into the self, sameness of what is constant and integral. That just means identity. Identity is oneness. It's a unity. Mm-hmm. It's a concentration into self, sameness.
So it's more beingness than being.
Yes.
Okay.
And what is constant and integrally present, is that so your identity, right? The preeminent determination of the thinking of beingness is then appropriately the unit of the I. So the I becomes this determination of the thinking of beingness, unity. I becomes the unity that is, in a sense, an example or a representation or a determiner of the unity of being and the unity of transcendental apperception. That's a phrase from Husserl, we talked about the self-sameness of the I, that's identity. Leibniz joins both of these in a deeper and richer sense in the monad. Mm-hmm. And I don't know much about Leibniz's monad, but let's see what Grok.
So I have to be honest that when I first read this, I was like, thought the one was more like being, like the individual, which is sort of what we're aspiring to, right? The being or bang. So I very much misunderstood the first time. And I was like, wow, the I think. Like, it felt so, like, it felt almost comforting with him saying this because it felt so classical in the way that I read it incorrectly. But it was like, it almost felt like Latin. I don't know. There was just something about it that felt very classical in how I read it. But now I see what it is. But there is something, it's weird, there's something a little comforting in being like, oh, the I think, yeah, right. We've heard that.
Yeah.
It's like the common language. That the common philosophical, I mean, it's what we've been brought up in.
Yes, yes, that's right. Yeah, it's our little fort. You thought it was beingness was one or being?
So when the first time I read it, I thought being was one.
I mean, that's what he says here, a being. So a being is a one. So think about horse, right. One horse.
Right, right, right.
Right?
Right.
But that being.
Oh, I see.
So it's a unity. But that unity is a unification, meaning a concentration into the self-sameness of what is constant and integrally present. You see?
So no, how did he get from being to being? Unity as beingness.
Well, when he says, so he's saying being was always determined also as a unity or a unit or a oneness, right?
Well, no, I thought one and a unit. Well, wait.
A being and a one, he says, are interchangeable.
Okay.
They're the same thing.
Well, so he's saying being and beingness are interchangeable?
No.
No.
No. Meaning like, okay, you have a horse, right? It's a being.
Yeah.
It's a one.
Mm-hmm.
It's a one thing. There's one horse.
Okay.
That's a couch. Look at the couch. It's a couch. It's a being. It's also a one.
Mm-hmm.
But what he says here, when they talk about it being a one, that oneness is a unity that is a beingness.
Okay.
Right, so in equating a being and with a one, and those being the same things,
okay,
you're in a sense sliding beingness in through the back door.
Okay,
right,
okay. Yeah.
But that unity here means actually a unification, meaning a bringing together of different things.
Yeah.
Meaning it becomes a self-sameness. So the self becomes the same as itself. It becomes, he's saying, it's an identity of what is constant and present. And this determination of the thinking of beingness is then appropriately the unity of the I. So the I becomes, in a sense, a mirroring or a facet or a offshoot of this unification that is the unity, that is the one, that is the being.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
I think so. I mean, it's kind of conflating my beingness, like...
Yes.
Differentness.
I think they are conflated.
Yeah.
I think that's what he's kind of pointing out, is that at the beginning, a being was always determined also as a one or a unit or a unity.
Yeah.
So in other words, it's not a two or a... because, for instance, there's a sense in which you can look at the couch, right, and think and not think, oh, it's a one. You could think it's a three. Couch is legs, arms, and pillows, and that's how you think of it. Literally, you never think couch, right? There's no singularity there, right? But in that. But the first beginning has trained us to think of a being as a one, not as a three, not as a nine, not as an infinity, but as a one.
Okay.
But in the idea of the one, right, that is a beingness, meaning because if every being is conceived of as a one, then the beingness of beings is that they are a one.
Yeah.
They all have that.
Yeah.
So for instance, we don't have some beings that are a one, some beings are a two, some beings are a nine, right? The universal thing of beings is that they are a one. But he says, but then what you need to think about that one is that them being a one is actually a unification of that being with itself. Its self-sameness over time and its presence. So that oneness is in a sense a two-ness or a multitude being unified into one. And that's where you then get to the unity of the I. The I is a multitude united into one. And it stands above everything as a one, but that unification makes it a beingness. So it's a being and it's a beingness. So he's giving us a little bit of an in to how this collusion between being and beingness has come about.
Right. That makes sense. Yeah.
So I was going to read about Leibniz's monad. I don't know. I'll read a little bit here. Leibniz's concept of monads is a cornerstone of his metaphysical philosophy. Monads are the fundamental, indivisible, and simple substances that constitute the universe. Simple substances. Monads are non-physical, indivisible entities without parts, distinct from material atoms. They are the ultimate building blocks of reality. Monads do not interact with each other or the external world. They have no windows through which anything can enter or leave. Instead, each monad contains within itself a complete representation of the entire universe from its unique perspective. Monads are characterized by two main activities: the internal representation of the universe, varying in clarity among monads, the tendency or drive to transition from one perceptual state to the next, affecting changes in the universe. Each monad is unique, differing in its perspective and degree of clarity in perceiving the universe. No two monads are identical. Since monads do not interact, their synchronized behavior is due to a divine pre-established harmony. There are simple monads, which are basic entities with unconscious perceptions, such as inanimate objects. There are souls, which are monads with conscious perceptions and memory. There are spirits, monads with self-awareness and reason, and there is God. So the souls are animals, the spirits are humans, and the simple monads are inanimate objects. I don't know how enlightening that was, but that's monad. Monads resolve the problem of how mind and matter relate, as they are neither purely physical nor purely mental, but bridge both through their internal activity. They explain the appearance of a unified, harmonious universe without requiring physical interaction. each monad reflects the entire universe. Leibniz developed the monad concept to address issues in Cartesian dualism and Spinoza's monism, offering a pluralistic metaphysics where a reality consists of infinitely many monads, each expressing the universe uniquely. This system supports his views on free will. Yeah. I think Heidegger is kind of saying that, the transcendental apperception, the self-sameness of the I, Leibniz kind of conjoined these ideas in the idea of the monad, that there are these discrete, single substances that vary in quality, but they are their biggest feature is their self-sameness, mm-hmm. And this is identity. This is what I talk mm-hmm. about, identity, scalp, sameness category, mm-hmm. anonymity, labeling, projection. The sameness is one of the qualities of identity. Mm-hmm. Again, I think Heidegger really early thinking about identity that I think he didn't fully develop, but I think that's where mm-hmm. he was headed. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What do you think?
I don't know. What do you think?
I don't know. Is there anything to say about all this? I mean, I feel there were some discoveries here just about how important this beingness versus being. Yeah. Essence versus existence, universal versus particular, and I would even say identity versus what individual, maybe, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. be a good way to dichotomize that. And that these distinctions are a real jungle mm-hmm. in which we attempt to survive. Mm-hmm. And that knowing or growing or increasingly conceiving of the degree and the ways in which we are compelled to relate to individuals as identities and to implant identities onto individuals. Mm-hmm. And I just mean individual people, but I mean monads in a way, like...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
Thought is, it might be interesting to point out that, Heidegger says there's these two types of thinking. One thinking is the reasoning that provides the domain in which representation takes place. Mm-hmm. The other is philosophizing, he mm-hmm. says, but he doesn't really go on to talk about what he means by mm-hmm. that. Mm-hmm. But it might be interesting to say, so the first type of thinking is the one that establishes these representations, mm-hmm. traffics in these representations, handles these representations, takes mm-hmm. these representations seriously, and essentializes them.
Yeah.
The second kind of thinking, philosophizing, is the one that existentializes them. Mm-hmm. Looks for and practices and develops an ability to distinguish mm-hmm. between individuals and identities, mm-hmm. between existences and essences, between particulars and universals, between being and beingness. Mm-hmm. That philosophy is the project of trying to see our way through those collusions and those cloudings and those confusions.
Yeah.
Right?
Totally.
And that is the path out of liberalism. That is the path out of anxiety. That is the path out mm-hmm. of ignorance. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the path we're on.
Yep.
That's the other beginning.
Yeah. Yeah. I was going to say that the sort of like the first representing is like the first beginning thinking.
Yeah.
And yeah. philosophizing is the yeah. second beginning. Yeah. Or other beginning thinking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's good, right?
Yeah. That's great.
Okay.
Yeah,
well, that's the episode, I guess. I guess The episode is over when a discovery has been made, and we made a discovery, right?
Exactly, yes.
Okay, good night.
Thanks for joining us for the Leaping Cholla podcast. For more information, visit leapingcholla.com and be sure and follow us on socials. Until next time.